You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. On March 12th of this year, Broadway theaters went dark, creating uncertainty for one of the most iconic and distinctly American forms of entertainment, and putting 95,000 actors, musicians, and theater hands out of work. It's not the first time Broadway has gone dark. It happened 13 times before, most often during union strikes, but never for this long and never with such devastating impact. But until the marquees light up once again, when we see crowds of eager theatergoers lining up and hear the sounds of orchestras tuning once more, let's think back to a time in recent memory, specifically the 1990s, when shows like Rent, The Lion King, Chicago, and The Producers dominated the Great White Way, and Broadway was one of the country's greatest cultural exports. Michael Riedel, the longtime theater columnist for the New York Post, tells the story of that transformative decade and the shows that changed the history of American theater in a new book titled Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. And today, Michael joins me on the podcast to discuss how British shows like Cats, Les Mis, and The Phantom of the Opera dominated New York theater in the 80s, and how an eclectic mix of old-school showmen, indie producers, and big corporations revived this uniquely American art form in the 90s. He recalls the disastrous Andrew Lloyd Webber musical that put an end to the so-called British invasion, and how a little musical called Rent took the world by storm and changed our idea of what a Broadway musical could be. We talk about how the musical Chicago went from a flop in the 70s to a massive hit in the 90s, how revivals of classic musical comedies like Guys and Dolls paved the way for Mel Brooks' The Producers, and the real-life story of the Broadway showman who turned out to be a con man. Plus, Michael shares his thoughts on the current theater shutdown, what Broadway may look like whenever it emerges from the pandemic, and some hopeful lessons from Broadway's dramatic recovery in the wake of the attacks on 9/11, coming up with Michael Riedel in just a moment. Michael Riedel has been the theater columnist for the New York Post since 1998. New York Magazine has called his column a must-read for the theater world. Michael began his radio career as a regular on the Imus in the Morning show in 2011, and he currently co-hosts the Len Berman and Michael Riedel in the Morning show on WOR, which is the highest-rated morning radio program in the New York City area. Michael's book, Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, won the Marfield Prize for Arts Writing in 2015 and is widely considered to be the successor to William Goldman's celebrated 1967 book about Broadway, The Season. Now Michael is out with a successor to his own book titled Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Michael Riedel, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be with you, Ben. Good to be with you.
Well, I really enjoyed this book. I am a big Broadway fan since I was a kid. And the thing that I love about all of this is the backstage stories and the rivalries and all of the, you know, come from behind successes of these shows and stuff. A lot of them sound straight out of a Busby Berkeley movie.
Okay.
But you open the book by saying that you didn't intend the subtitle of the book, The Triumph of Broadway, to be ironic.
No, I certainly did not.
Yeah, Broadway certainly doesn't feel very triumphant right now, does it?
Yeah, The Triumph of Broadway certainly is an ironic title. I mean, I finished the book in February, turned the manuscript in, and then went off to Switzerland and Italy to ski. And while I was there, I took a picture of a glass of wine I was drinking on the slopes of northern Italy with the Matterhorn in the background, texted to my girlfriend. She said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm in Italy." She said, "Do you have any idea what's going on?" I was vaguely aware of the coronavirus, but I wasn't paying that much attention to it, to be honest with you. I was paying more attention to the primaries, Biden versus Bernie Sanders then. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Get out of Italy. You know, this thing is spiking all over the place." And I was like, "Yeah, well, you know, please. It's in China. Maybe it'll hit Seattle. I'm not too concerned." Within 2 days, the resort I was in was shut down because of the coronavirus. Wow. And when I got back to New York, a few days after I got back, Broadway was shut down. And I swear to God, everybody thought it'll be shut down for 2 weeks and we'll be back. And, you know, 8 months into it, there's really no end in sight. I mean, when it can come back, my sense is, from what I get talking to all the producers, is probably not until there's a vaccine. And that's going to be a year and a half from now before people feel safe to go back to the theater.
Well, let me ask you about a different sort of disaster. You end the book by talking about what has to be the darkest day in New York City history, September 11th, 2001. That was another moment when there were serious doubts about whether the theater business and the city as a whole could survive it. But Broadway somehow managed to bounce back surprisingly quickly. Tell us about that.
One day I was looking out my window here in the West Village where I live in New York, and I thought, you know, once upon a time I had a full-on view of the World Trade Center. And in fact, I saw the two planes hit the buildings and I saw the towers fall right here. And I lived through and I covered Broadway's remarkable comeback after September 11th. And, you know, we forget now, but that day, September 11th, 2001, I remember talking to the head of the Schubert Organization, Jerry Schoenfeld, and he said, "Michael, I don't know how we're going to survive." Because you have to remember, Ben, we had no idea that there weren't going to be more terrorists here. Right. Times Square would definitely have been a target for a terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. You know, the year before, I think in Moscow, terrorists had taken over a theater and killed 170 people. So there were fears that if you open Broadway, a bunch of terrorists might come in and shoot up the audience. But Rudy Giuliani, the sane Rudy Giuliani, understood that he wanted to signal to the world that New York was not brought to its knees by the terrorists. And the best way to do it was to light the lights of Broadway, because, you know, New York has one thing that no other city has, and that's Broadway. There's the West End in London, and there are theaters all around the country and around the world. But Broadway as an entity, you say Broadway and people instantly know what Broadway is. And that is so identified with New York City that to get those theaters up and running 2 days after the attack on the World Trade Center was a huge symbol to say to the world that New York City was open for business. And, you know, within a year, and it was very moving that night, as I detail in the book, I went with Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft to the producers, which was then the hottest show in the world. And I stood at the back of the theater with them. And at the end of the show, Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane led theater. Maybe it was half full because people were, you know, scared, and some couldn't get in the city back then, but maybe 800, 900 people in the theater. And they led them singing, you know, "God Bless America" in tears. And it was incredibly moving. And within a year, Broadway was back to posting record grosses. And through a series of strategies I outlined in the book, it was a really, really remarkable comeback. Yeah. So that's why I subtitled the book The Triumph of Broadway.
Now, the pandemic is, of course, a very different kind of disaster for Broadway. But I wonder if you see any hopeful parallels between these two events.
You know, the big difference between the pandemic and September 11th was, after the terrorist attacks, people wanted to be together. You know, they wanted to come together to support each other. And a great way for people to come together is to go to the theater. But the coronavirus means you can't be together. So you can't go to the theaters. The actors can't perform because they could give the disease to each other. The musicians can't be in the pit. They're blowing on their instruments. That's the way you spread the virus. So you could not have engineered something more devastating to the theater than the coronavirus.
Yeah. And traditionally, Broadway sees a lot of big openings in those 2 or 3 months leading up to the Tony Awards. I wonder what's going to happen to the shows that either had just opened and were trying to find their legs, or the shows that were in previews or planning to open last spring.
Some of them will never come back. You know, they just financially, they won't be able to hold it together. I think when Broadway does come back, you're going to see some of the stalwarts, The Lion King, Phantom of the Opera, Wicked. I mean, those shows have made so much money. Their backers have a financial cushion to try to start them up again. And you'll see a big show like Hugh Jackman and The Music Man. You know, that'll be something that'll entice people back to the theater. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the shows that were kind of struggling even before the pandemic hit, that you won't see them come back. And, you know, you're not going to see every theater full, maybe 8 or 9 shows when it first comes back. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to see ticket prices at $1,000, you know, having gone through this pandemic and this great recession that we're in right now, there's no way Broadway can open and say, hey, we're back in business. Come and pay $1,000 to see Hamilton.
Yeah.
That means the theater owners and producers are going to have to figure out a whole new financial structure, negotiating with all the unions to make the theater affordable to entice people to come back.
I'll tell you, this is one thing that concerns me about the future. I know that the Wickeds and the Lion Kings of Broadway will survive post-pandemic, but I worry about revivals. You mentioned The Music Man, which of course has a big star, so you know, it'll probably be fine. But do you think that I'm ever going to be able to take my daughter to see classics like Oklahoma, My Fair Lady, Kiss Me, Kate, and all of these, you know, really great Broadway classics, the kind of shows that we think of, in any other setting than a high school musical when this all settles down?
Yeah, I mean, those shows are classics and great shows, and there will be a whole new generation of theater performers and directors who will have a different kind of a take on those shows and will reinvent them for a new generation, your daughter probably. But yeah, it's going to take some time. You know, it's going to take some time.
Yeah. Well, I certainly appreciate both in your book and in everything that you say, your passion for the theater. It really does come across in Singular Sensation. Where did your love of theater come from?
I wasn't a theater kid growing up, really. I came to New York and I was a history major in college, and I was going to be a lawyer. And then I took a job with a Broadway producer for the summer. I mean, I didn't really know what a Broadway producer did, but it was just a summer job that was advertised at Columbia, and I needed to make some money that summer. So I worked in the producer of Elizabeth McCann, and she was producing a play called Les Liaisons Dangereuses, starring one Alan Rickman, before he was famous. And I got to kind of hang around the theater, and I enjoyed the colorful characters. I got to know all the actors in the play, and they were fun. And I got to know a lot of the theater owners, the Schuberts, the Niederlanders. And that kind of got me interested in the business of theater, you know, the behind the scenes things that go on. I'm not a critic. You know, I never wanted to be someone who just went to the theater and went home by himself and wrote little book reports about what I saw. I like to hang out with theater people because they have great stories. And that's really how I fell in love with it. It was mainly the colorful cast of characters than it was the art form. And so if you read my books, Razzle Dazzle and Singular Sensation, you see they don't concentrate on the, you know, the big name stars. They concentrate on the people behind the scenes, the theater owners, the producers, and how they put these shows together. And the, you know, this hyper competitive atmosphere that exists on Broadway. You know, you really have to, your show's got to be the number one box office draw, which means it's going to take audiences away from the guy who's next door to you. And then come the Tony Awards, the competition is unbelievably cutthroat and fierce. And I always enjoyed writing about those times because it makes theater people extremely edgy and very nervous. And they're hyper to begin with and eccentric to begin with. But around the Tony Award time, they go completely out of their minds.
I'll bet.
Kind of fun to torture them, actually.
Yeah. So you write more about the behind the scenes. You don't consider yourself a theater critic?
No, not really.
You don't review shows?
I certainly have strong opinions about the shows that I like and dislike.
Right. So that's an element of it.
Yeah. But I'm more interested in shows that had some sort of impact, whether it be financially or culturally. And, you know, the challenge in writing Singular Sensation is I write about a lot of shows that everyone's seen, of course, Rent, Chicago, Lion King, the producers. And a lot of people know the stories of these shows. I mean, you know The Lion King is going to be a big hit. You know The Producers is going to be a big hit. You know Rent's going to be a big hit. But what I try to get at is the people who created those shows and who invested in those shows, who produced those shows, they did not know how those shows were going to turn out. So I went back, and this is not a memoir and this is not a collection of my columns from the 90s. I went back and I interviewed everybody who was involved in all these big shows I talk about. And I would say to them, don't think ahead. Don't tell me. And of course, we knew it was going to be a hit and did this and we did that. I said, take me right back to the first time you read the script, what you thought about it. Take me to the first day of rehearsal. I want to go to that first dress rehearsal. What did you make of it? The first time you saw a complete run through of the show. What was it like the night just before the curtain went up on the very first public performance of the show? And every single one of the people I interviewed told me, Michael, you know, we had no idea what we had. We were absolutely terrified. Because in the theater, as my old friend Peter Stone, who wrote 1776 and Titanic, said, he said, in the theater, Michael, you do not know what you have until your show plays its first performance in front of 1,500 people who paid for their seats. That's when you begin to realize you've got a hit on your hands, or man, are we in trouble.
Yeah, and that's some of the thrill of it, the riverboat gambler aspect of a lot of these producers. Now, I mentioned that Singular Sensation is a sequel of sorts to your previous book, Razzle Dazzle, which chronicled Broadway in the 70s and 80s. So in order to set the scene for this latest book, briefly remind us what happened in those two decades leading up to the 90s.
Yeah, well, this book, you know, my first book, Razzle Dazzle, ended in the early 90s when my main characters died, which is always a good way to end a book, when your main characters die. It's one way to put a period at the end of things. In any case, my publisher, Simon & Schuster, Avid Reader Press, they wanted a sequel. And I began to think, well, what's a sequel to that? Because the first book was really the struggle to save Broadway in the 60s and 70s, when the city was going bankrupt and Times Square was full of prostitutes and drug dealers, and there were very few shows around, and theaters were being torn down because they had more valuous parking lots. And it was about the handful of people who really kind of saved Broadway in the 70s and led to that kind of a boom in the 80s with the Cameron Mackintosh, Andrew Lloyd Webber shows like Cats and Phantom and Les Mis.
So your two books focus on these two really highly productive periods in recent Broadway history. How was New York theater in the 90s different from what preceded it?
You know, the 90s was a time on Broadway, and this book takes place in the 1990s, when the theater really once again became the center of American popular culture in a way it had not been really since the golden age of the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. Shows like Rent and Chicago, Angels in America, The Lion King, The Producers. I mean, those shows were as well known, as big as any movie or television show of the era, you know, and they spawned productions that went all over the world. So the 90s was a boom time for Broadway, an exciting time, a really exciting time. And you had, you know, just major, major talents working in the theater then. Julie Taymor and Mel Brooks and Nathan Lane, Matthew Broderick, Tony Kushner, people like that. And I thought, well, the 90s, you know, a lot of art forms, they have that kind of that key decade or that key period of time, you know, the golden age of the Broadway musical really is about 15, 20 years there from end of World War II to the 60s when taste changed. And, you know, you had the great era of Hollywood in the 30s and 40s, and then the studio system falls apart. But then you have movie makers like Francis Ford Coppola and Martin Scorsese and those great movie makers of the 70s that are transforming the business. So I thought I could actually look at this decade on Broadway where big, big changes took place, where Disney came on the scene and a corrupt guy like Garth Drabinsky, who built this empire that was a total sham, he arrived, really changed things.
Now, we mentioned earlier that your previous book largely focused on the 70s and particularly the 80s, when sort of the British invasion happened on Broadway. You had Andrew Lloyd Webber and other composers like Buble and Schoenberg. Of course, the producer Cameron Mackintosh just dominating American theater. The next book here actually begins with the end of that, which ironically happens when the same man that sort of kicked it off, Andrew Lloyd Webber, gets this idea to do a musical of Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard. Now, in the face of that, you got a well-known Hollywood classic. You got Andrew Lloyd Webber writing the score. Glenn Close for a star. Would seem like a recipe for a hit. What goes wrong there?
Well, that was the era where, as these big shows, shows with chandeliers and helicopters and turntables, everybody seemed to want everything with big, lavish special effects. And Sunset Boulevard, you know, it had Norma Desmond's mansion, which actually flew, you know, it actually levitated above the stage and flew out. I remember seeing it, I thought, well, I mean, this is a hugely expensive production, but dramatically, the only house I know that ever flew was in The Wizard of Oz when the tornado hit it. So it just seemed to me, it was over the top, you know, so much money was spent on it. And behind the scenes, it had all kinds of feuds going on, you know, Patti LuPone and Andrew Lloyd Webber had a famous feud and he fired her. And then he fired Faye Dunaway from the Los Angeles production, and everybody was suing everybody else. And he had a falling out with Glenn Close at one point. And the show just, it wasn't in the newspapers because it was good, although I think it's a fine show, and I think it's one of Andrew's best score. It always seemed to be in the papers because of controversy,
you know?
Behind the scenes drama, backstabbing, all that kind of stuff. And it was also wildly expensive. I mean, I think it was $14 million, the most expensive show of all time in New York. And you have to remember that as much as you and I may love Sunset Boulevard, it still remains something of a kind of a cult movie for people who are real fans of Hollywood and show business. It never really had that wide mainstream appeal that, say, I mean, Cats has mainstream appeal because half the world loves Cats. So there you go. There's a big audience for you right there. Sunset Boulevard never really had that. And it was just so expensive. It cost so much to run that it ran 2.5, 3 years, I guess. Can't remember now. And it sort of looked like it was a hit. But when Glenn Close left it, the box office was never as strong as it was when she was in it. And then the whole thing just kind of imploded on itself.
And I remember in one of the weirder twists, I don't know, for some reason, Weber hired a New York lawyer with no professional theater experience to write the lyrics for the show. Do you remember how did that happen?
Yeah, the first person, one of the first people he hired, and I opened the book with an interview I did with her. Her name was Amy Powers, and she was a young lawyer, but she wanted to write lyrics. And a friend introduced her to Lloyd Webber, or told Lloyd Webber about her. And one day she got a call. Hello, this is Andrew Lloyd Webber. Would you like to come to the South of France? And so the next day she's on a plane and she worked with Andrew, but you know, she was kind of a novice lyricist. And Andrew brought in his old pal, Don Black, who's a well-known lyricist. You know, he wrote Born Free and Thunderball and Aspects of Love with Andrew. And pretty soon, poor little Amy Powers was banished from the Lloyd Webber kingdom. And as I say, hers was the first head that rolled down Sunset Boulevard, because a lot more heads were to follow hers. But the whole point of opening with Sunset Boulevard was we didn't know at the time that this was going to be the end of an era. I mean, it still looked like Andrew was on top and those kind of big shows what the audience wanted. But as Sunset Boulevard began collapsing, there was a kid working on a show, somebody none of us had ever heard of before, writing a show we'd never heard of before, that where Sunset Boulevard cost $14 million, this show would cost about $100,000 off Broadway. And that show was Rent, written by Jonathan Larson. Sunset collapses. And then, you know, sad to say, Jonathan died before he saw the success of Rent. He died right after the first dress rehearsal, alone in his apartment when he put on the tea kettle and had an aneurysm, dead before he hit the floor of his kitchen. But that ended the British era. And then after Rent, you get the Americans come back to Broadway. You get Chicago, and you get, you know, the plays with Tony Kushner, and you get Edward Albee's great return from the wilderness of all those years. And, you know, you've got the revival of Guys and Dolls with Nathan Lane, directed by Jerry Zaks. And that all kind of leads up to, you know, the great musical comedy of the era. Mel Brooks is the producers.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. I remember being in New York in that moment between the time that Rent opened and the Tony Awards, and how meaningful it felt to people because, you know, the creator, like you said, Jonathan Larson, had passed away just months before, and it was this little show that could. But even more than that, it felt like this massive cultural shift on Broadway and even a movement almost in a way.
Yeah. Well, you know, what was interesting about Rent, and I thought about this as I was putting together these chapters on the show, you look at the shows that were popular before Rent. Okay, you had Sunset Boulevard, and you know that's set in Hollywood of the 1950s and the 1920s. You know, Les Mis is set in the Revolution of 1848 in Paris, and there's Phantom of the Opera, a romantic musical set in the Paris Opera House of the 19th century, and Cats. I don't know where Cats is set. I mean, it's on a tire with a lot of smoke. But Rent was set in contemporary times. It was set in what was happening in New York then. It was about struggling artists. It was about kids who had drug problems. It was about people who were dying of AIDS. It was about the gentrification of neighborhoods that were pushing these struggling artists out of their apartments because they could no longer afford them. And it was about young people. It was not set in the remote past. It was not set in a fantasy world. It was set in New York City of the time, and it made Broadway contemporary again. Mm-hmm. You went to Rent, and what you saw on that stage, you could look around when you left the theater and you saw happening around you outside. And it just made Broadway it just made the musical theater feel relevant in a way it had not felt in a long time.
And the plot of Rent was heavily autobiographical for the creator, Jonathan Larson. He really was this classic tale of the starving artist who struggles and struggles and only finds success and fame after his death. Yeah. How much of the bittersweet narrative played into the mystique around Rent?
Well, I did not meet Jonathan Larson because he died. I'd never heard of him. I remember the press agent for the show called me. I was at the Daily News then covering the theater, and he called me and said, I've got some sad news. I said, what? He said, Jonathan Larson died last night and we're just about to open his show Rent. And I said, Richard, who's Jonathan Larson? I barely heard of this little show off Broadway. And I remember saying, well, I mean, I can only give you about a paragraph because no one's ever heard of this kid. But what I tried to get across in the Jonathan Larson story was I really wanted to show his real struggle to get that show together. Because the myth is kind of sprung up that, he came out of nowhere and he had this great show and then he died and it was tragic. He had been knocking around New York for a long time and he was really at the end of his rope when he was writing Rent. I mean, he was completely out of money. He'd had a couple of shows that just didn't, they were good, but they just didn't go anywhere. He'd had a lot of disappointments. And he was telling friends if Rent didn't work out, he was going to have to reevaluate his entire life and figure out something else to do, because he would have had to admit the failure in his dream to become a musical theater writer. It just was not happening for him. And so I wanted to convey that sense of desperation, this is my last chance. And just as it's coming together, the unthinkable happens, and he just dies so tragically.
Is it fair to say that Rent paved the way for more shows like Avenue Q that didn't really fit that traditional mold of what a Broadway show was prior to that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, if you talk to people like Bobby Lopez, who wrote Avenue Q and wrote the Book of Mormon, he fell in love with the theater because of Rent. I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who did Hamilton, says he saw Rent 32 or 33 times. Tom Kitt, Brian Yorkey, who did Next to Normal, all this generation of very talented musical theater writers all came to the theater not because of Cats or Phantom, but really because of Rent. That was the show that got them thinking, geez, I can write a show that's contemporary, that's young, that's relevant, because that's what Jonathan Larson did.
And I guess equally significant is the fact that this heavyweight producer who dominated the business for a decade or more, Cameron McIntosh, largely takes a break in the 90s with a few not so notable exceptions. And yeah, that void is filled by this whole new generation of American producers who ranged from those who still kind of fit that classic archetype of the Broadway showman to the big corporations and movie studios like Disney, and also this new breed of more daring indie producers like the ones behind Rent. It strikes me as a surprisingly eclectic group that emerged in the 90s.
Yeah, Kevin McCollum and Jeffrey Seller were the two young producers of Rent. And, they were pretty much unknown to me back in those days. They were, Jeffrey was working in a little booking office and Kevin owned the office, but he just bought out his partner, so they didn't have any money. And they were really scraping stuff together to get Rent going. But, Kevin and Jeffrey, after the success of Rent, they went on to do Avenue Q. And Jeffrey, of course, did Hamilton, and Kevin's done Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. So they became major, major players. And they were kind of the new breed of a younger group of producers. My friend David Stone, he was coming up in the ranks then with, he had the Vagina Monologues, and eventually he got Wicked, which has made him a vast amount of money, I can assure you. And, then two of my favorite characters in the book, old friends of mine, are Fran and Barry Weissler, who are really, they are classic Broadway characters, and they produce Chicago. And again, we think of Chicago as this hugely successful empire, but it started out as a concert at the Encore series here at City Center. It was to run only four performances. And Fran and Barry caught one of the last performances and they loved it. And Fran called her friend Fred Ebb, who with John Kander wrote the show. And she said, Fred, if you could find it in your heart just to give us a little piece of the show when it moves to Broadway, we would be so grateful. And Fred said to Fran, he said, Fran, no one's called about it. Because everybody thought, well, it's a concert. It doesn't have a chandelier that falls. It doesn't have a turntable. It doesn't cost a gazillion dollars. It's just this concert. Who's going to pay? And this is kind of hilarious. Who's going to pay the top ticket price in 1996 of $75 to see a concert on Broadway? So nobody wanted to produce Chicago. And Fran and Barry, they couldn't raise the money. they couldn't raise the money to get the show up. And they had a couple million dollars, maybe. They'd been, you know, successful on Broadway, but they were by no means, you know, Cameron McIntosh kind of rich. Mm-hmm. And they violated Mel Brooks's cardinal rule of showbiz. They decided to put their own money into the show. And I have this scene in my book, as Fran told me. She said, you know, that night, Barry and I, we crawled into bed and I turned out the light and I pulled the covers over my head. And I said, what have we done? What have we done? You know, 23 years later, the worldwide gross of Chicago stands at about $4 billion. And Fran and Barry have about 75% of that. Yeah. And I have seen the estate that Chicago built.
Yeah. They're the only people that I know who have their own amphitheater in their backyard.
They do. That's right. Chicago money is very, very good money. But again, that's an example of, I really wanted to put the reader in Fran and Barry's lives and minds at the time. Mm. And the real fear that they had, you know, putting a lot of their significant amount of their net worth into a show that everybody was saying, oh, come on, it was from the 70s. It was overshadowed by a Chorus Line. The only people who know Chicago are a bunch of musical theater fans. Yeah. It never had currency beyond the musical theater geeks. And who's going to pay to see, you know, people just wearing black dresses? People saying, and the orchestra's on stage. Nobody wants to see an orchestra on stage. It was the most ridiculous thing you could do.
Yeah. And now the original 1975 production of Chicago, I think it closed after less than 3 months, but then this revival, as you kind of mentioned, it's the longest running revival and the second longest running musical after Phantom.
Yeah.
Why was it a flop in 75 and a massive hit in the 90s?
Well, I'll tell you, a couple of things. In the 70s, directed by Bob Fosse, because the show, as you know, it's a fun show. It's a musical comedy, but it's brutally cynical. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes fun of the justice system. It's all showbiz folks. It's all smoke and mirrors. How can they see with sequins in their eyes? You know, and if you got a good show, the lawyer's got a good show, you can get the murderess out of jail, which is what happens. So there was a kind of darkness to it that maybe was a little bit ahead of its time, a biting satire, some tough staging by Bob Fosse. But it was also completely overwhelmed that season by A Chorus Line, which became the great show and just smothered Chicago. Now you jump ahead to the mid-90s. Now, why does Chicago work? Interestingly, because the 6 months before Chicago opens, you have Rent, which I said is now contemporary, right?
Right.
Now, what is Chicago about? It's about the justice system as showbiz. So what is going on in America at that time that Chicago opens at Encores? The O.J. Simpson trial. How can they see with sequins in their eyes? If the glove don't fit, you must acquit. Suddenly, Chicago was relevant because every night we were seeing essentially the musical Chicago played out in a Los Angeles courtroom with Johnny Cochran as Billy Flynn.
Yeah, I've heard that before. I've heard the whole O.J. theory of Chicago.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, it had currency. It had currency.
Yeah. And within the business, one thing that the Weislers were known for is, you know, being able to pay these big bucks to attract huge movie and TV stars back to Broadway. And in the case of Chicago, after the original cast, they just cycled in one star into the cast after another. I wonder, do you think that these big marquee names breathed life into productions that maybe should have closed long before they did in some cases?
Yeah, Fran and Barry were remarkable with casting because they were always able to keep the show fresh by bringing in some big names. And so just when you thought, well, maybe Chicago's about running its course, you know, Melanie Griffith would pop into it or Usher would appear into it. And it was fun for these actors to do it because they didn't have to give a major time commitment. They could give 3 months, you know, and they could get good reviews because they were all re-reviewed and they would have a good time on Broadway. I mean, I remember when Melanie Griffith went into the show, I was getting reports that she was not good at all. She was terrible. And I called Barry and I said, Barry, what's going on? He said, well, you can't sing, you can't dance, but I got to tell you, she's terrific. And sure enough, you went to see it. I mean, she's playing Roxy Hart, who can't sing and can't dance. So she was perfect for the parts.
Oh, that's
great.
And
she was terrific. You know, it worked.
Now, I have to bring up another one of these larger-than-life characters behind the scene, Garth Drabinski. You have a couple of chapters on him. And, you know, this is a guy who was one part showman and two parts con man.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I can remember what a big force to be reckoned with he was in the 90s. He was just such an over the top character, and his rise and fall is really fascinating. For anyone who is not well versed in the backstory of all of these things, talk a little about him.
Well, Garth made his name in the movie business. He created Cineplex Odeon. He was the first guy to come up with the multiplex. You know, that was his idea. And, you know, they were lushly appointed theaters, and he was the first guy to use real butter on the popcorn. Before that, people used, you know, flavored oil because it was cheaper, but, you know, no expense spared. You could have espressos in the cafe in the theaters. So Garth was always thinking big and, importantly, spending big. He was always spending, 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 spending. And eventually, you know, he was partners with Lou Wasserman, the most powerful Hollywood mogul back in the 80s and 90s. And eventually Lou and Garth had a huge falling out, and he pushed Garth out of the company. But as part of Garth's exit package, he got the Canadian rights to The Phantom of the Opera. And he opened that up in Toronto in an incredibly lavish production that was a massive hit in Toronto. And on the back of Phantom, he built up this empire called Livent, which was the first publicly traded live theatrical company on the New York and Canadian stock exchanges. So he was actually floating shares. And, you know, there were these big pension funds in Canada that were invested heavily in live and stock. And Garth did these gigantic shows, you know, Kiss of the Spider Woman. He did a revival of Showboat that cost $10 million.
Right, I mean, unheard of
for a revival. Showboat's a fine show, all right? But I mean, come on, it's from the 1920s. It's a little long in the tooth. A $10 million revival of Showboat? How long do you think that's going to run, right? You know, it was beautiful, beautifully done by Hal Prince and all. But Garth spent, and he spent, and he spent. And he built a gigantic theater here in New York, the Ford Center. He acquired theaters or built theaters across the country. And he was the real rival to the other big corporation at the time, and that was Disney. Mm-hmm. And from the outside, you thought, wow, I mean, these shows must be making a fortune, and Garth can always go to the stock exchange and raise more money. So there's kind of an endless supply of resources and money and revenue for him to spend lavishly on these shows, produce these shows so lavishly. But there were a few people on Broadway, and not to be too immodest, but I was one of them, who understood the economics of a Broadway show. And you would see these shows and you'd think, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, he's buying, you know, in the New York Times alone, he's buying 3 pages worth of ads every Sunday for Showboat. You know, maybe a show would buy 1 page every other Sunday, but 3 pages every Sunday? And that wasn't just in New York. He would do it if he had a show in L.A., in Chicago, in Seattle, in Vancouver, in Toronto, in Washington. And that kind of spending is just, you can't justify it with the amount of money a show actually brings in each week. So some of us were a little, I don't think we understood the extent of what was going on, but we just had our suspicions that there's something that just doesn't add up here. These figures, it just doesn't make sense. And some of the wiser old heads on Broadway, the Schuberts, the Niederlanders, they also would shake their head in private conversations with me. They say, I just don't understand how this thing's going to work. And I remember one of them saying, you know, Michael, I think this whole thing is a Ponzi scheme, and it is going to fall apart. And indeed, by the end of the 90s, turned out that Garth and his business partner, Myron Gottlieb, they literally, like the Alistock and Bloom, they'd kept 2 sets of books. They had 1 set of books that showed their investors and the stock exchange and the auditors that all their shows made money and everything was great. And they had a secret set of books that showed this ever-widening sea of red ink. And at the end of the day, both Garth and Myron went to jail in Canada for forgery and fraud.
Wow. Quite a story. Yeah. Now, speaking of Bialystok and Bloom, I wonder how much of the success of revivals in the 90s like Guys and Dolls, Chicago, Crazy for You, which is sort of a revival, but not quite, paved the way for what I think is the Broadwayest of all Broadway musicals, The Producers.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the threads that emerges in Singular Sensation is the return of the American musical comedy. Mm-hmm. And that really begins in the 90s with Crazy for You, which used old Gershwin songs, but it had a new script. And it was so brilliantly directed by Mike Ockrent and Susan Stroman, it felt new. Yeah. And I remember I was trying to kind of trace in my mind, I was trying to figure out, all right, what would be the show that really began to remind us of the joys of American musical comedy? And I, you know, I was there for Crazy for You, and I thought, yeah, Crazy for You was a lot of fun. It really had so much energy, seemed to whole lift the whole business back in the early 90s. So I went back and I read Frank Rich's, he was the New York Times critic then, I read his review of the show. And his opening paragraph, and I'm paraphrasing here, said, when future historians of Broadway go back to figure out when the Americans took back the theater from the British, they can start with Crazy for You. I thought, aha, I got it. And Crazy for You was followed a few months later by the wonderful revival of Guys and Dolls with Nathan Lane that, again, did not feel that it was old. It did not feel that it was a show from the 1950s, because Jerry Zaks, the director of it, and Michael David, who produced it, they did not want to just take something out of the mothballs and put it up in an old-fashioned way. They wanted to treat Guys and Dolls as if it were a new show, as if the script and the score had just been turned in by young writers, and they were going to have to stage this musical as if it had never been staged before. And so, therefore, Jerry Zaks did not want older stars in it. He wanted people that the public really didn't know, such as one Nathan Lane and one Faith Prince, who became stars because of Guys and Dolls. And that excitement, that energy, that reminding American audiences of the real pleasure of a great musical comedy is what ultimately leads to Mel Brooks creating the, you know, the big musical comedy of the decade, and that's The Producers.
And what I loved most about The Producers was, you know, even though it was a big musical with broad appeal, if you were a real theater fan, it was just packed with this whole other layer of, you know, kind of traditional Mel Brooks gags and references to Broadway history, from the posters in Max Bialystock's office to final scene with the various marquees lighting up with titles like High Button Jews and a streetcar named Murray.
And cats,
I never laughed more in my life.
Cats, K-A-T-Z, and she strips to conquer, which happens to be my favorite. You know, it was interesting. I always try to interview as many of members of the creative team as the show as I can, which includes the costume designers and the set designers, because they have a lot of insight into how these shows come together. And I interviewed the brilliant Robin Wagner, who did the sets for The Producers. And I didn't realize this at the time I saw the show. It completely eluded me. But Robin pointed it out to me. He said, you know, I realized in Mel's script there were lots of references to all kinds of shows from the past. So in my set designs for the show, they also echo great Broadway musicals of the past. So he has, you know, in one scene, he has just the brick wall, the back of a theater. Well, that's Kiss Me, Kate. That's Kiss Me, Kate. Another scene, the Little Old Lady song where they're all tap dancing on their walkers. Right. That whole set echoes the Loveland set from Stephen Sondheim's Follies.
You're right. That's funny. I never even thought about that.
Yeah. So throughout that, there are all these echoes of other Broadway shows. And there's a mirror. There's some use of a mirror somewhere in the show. I'm trying to remember where, but that was an echo of the mirror in Cabaret.
Right. Yeah. And didn't they do a Busby Berkeley style thing too at some point? Probably in Springtime for Hitler. Yeah.
Yeah. They had Busby Berkeley and all these great shows that are all just kind of embedded in Mel's script, and then, you know, subtly Robin embeds them in his set designs.
Wow.
I love those kind of discoveries as a reporter. Because these creative people, they're so talented and smart. They don't emphasize it all. It's just there, and it kind of seeps into your understanding of and your enjoyment of the show without realizing it's happening.
Now, I feel like I'd be remiss if before we go, I didn't mention Rosie O'Donnell. I remember her show. She was just the best ambassador for Broadway and really advocated for shows that she liked. How influential was she in terms of promoting the whole New York theater scene to the rest of the country, the people who maybe had never seen a show in their life?
Very important. I mean, she really was to Broadway in the 90s what Ed Sullivan was to the theater in the 50s and the 60s with his hugely popular television show. She loved Broadway. She went to see all the shows. She talked about them on her talk show every morning. She reached 6 or 7 million, mainly women, who, by the way, buy the tickets to Broadway. Most of the tickets to Broadway are bought by women. Then they tell their husbands, honey, we're going to the show tonight. And he goes, oh my God, help me. But it's the women who decide what show the guys are going to see. And she put members of the cast on her show. And importantly, she did numbers from the show, numbers from the musicals on her TV show. And up until then, the only time you ever really got to see a musical number on television was once a year at the Tony Awards.
Mm-hmm. Or Letterman occasionally used to do that.
Occasionally, but not to the extent that Rosie did it. And, you know, she had a profound influence on the success of shows. One of my favorite shows from the 90s, which I write about, is Laurie Yeston and Peter Stone's Titanic. And that was a show that had a lot of trouble in previews and really, really was struggling. And it got mixed reviews from the critics. Rosie went to see it and she loved it. And the next day she talked it up on her show. And then she brought the cast on to sing the stirring opening number. And the box office quadrupled the next day. And that was a lifeline, if you will, to Titanic. Unfortunately for Rosie, she then decided to produce her own show, Taboo, which was a $10 million fiasco. That's not really in the book because that was in the 2000s. Yeah. But if I ever get a writing around, if I ever get around to writing a third installment of my history of Broadway, Taboo will definitely be a chapter because it was a wild time, believe me.
Yeah. And I remember, speaking of Fran and Barry, wasn't there a period when she was the Cat in the Hat in Seussical? She was a pretty hefty Cat in the Hat.
She certainly, yeah. Now, Fran and Barry produced Seussical, the musical, which was a fiasco on Broadway, and they tried to save it by putting Rosie into a rather large cat suit.
Well, real quickly before we go, just looking ahead to the future again, is it fair to say that you're bullish on Broadway post-pandemic, whenever that happens?
You know, it's funny. I'm writing a piece for the Wall Street Journal now about how Broadway has overcome crises in the past, including the Great Depression and, you know, the 60s and 70s when Times Square was sleazy and the theaters were empty and, as I said, being torn down. You know, the AIDS. I mean, Broadway had its own pandemic in the 80s, and that was AIDS. You know, when no one, when the mainstream, mainstream America, when heterosexual America was not paying much attention to AIDS, many people on Broadway were dying of it, you know. And Broadway had to come up with its own support system to help those people. And it did with Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS. And then, of course, September 11th and how it went through that crisis. This one is different because Broadway's never been shut down this long. And so much of this is really out of Broadway's control because it's really about getting a vaccine so that people feel safe going back to the theater again. So I do think it will come back. And I think when it comes back, Broadway is very good at staging comebacks. They know how to bring the showbiz excitement to the return of the Great White Way. And I know they will do that brilliantly. It's just a question of when will they be able to do that. And I don't think anyone can answer that question right now.
Yeah, well, hopefully something to look forward to. And again, I just really adored this book. The stories are fantastic. I highly recommend it to folks. It's called Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Michael Riedel, thanks for talking with me.
A pleasure, Ben. Anytime. Thanks for the interest.
Thanks again to Michael Riedel for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Listen to the Len Berman and Michael Riedel in the Morning Show on WOR Radio in New York. Look for his column in the New York Post and follow him on Twitter at Michael Riedel NY. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.